It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, some comments on state politics recorded last Thursday at our Pints and Politics event in Cedar Rapids in partnership with the Gazette. But first, possible changes in the state's so-called Stand Your Ground law. Stand Your Ground laws remove your obligation to retreat before using force in self-defense. And many states have enacted so-called Stand Your Ground laws. Florida passed the first such law. That was in 2005, generally allowing people to stand their ground instead of retreating if they reasonably believe doing so will prevent death or great bodily harm. That's the Florida law. Joining us for this discussion from the State House Law Library, our own Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Hello, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Also with us, two lawmakers with different opinions on this, Republican State Senator Mark Shelgren from Ottumwa. Senator Shelgren, thank you for stepping in.
Thank you for having me.
And Democratic State Representative Mary Wolf from Clinton. And Mary, I understand before I characterize yours as an opposing view and that you don't agree with, so we'll just call it a different view and hear from you in just a moment. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Let's start off, Senator Shelgren. Tell us, what is in this bill that would change from what we have now? Senate File 25, how does it expand Iowa Stand Your Ground law?
Well, the basic premise behind this is that right now in Iowa, you have a duty to retreat. So if you believe that there's a risk to you, then your first choice of action is to leave. As far as I'm concerned, that means that we've really limited the ability for good people to stand up and try to protect others.
Mm-hmm. What is the wording? Because the way you've just said it and it, you know, you can believe you are in grave danger but may not be in it. What is the wording that is in the bill that describes the level of threat that needs to be reached for you to lawfully defend yourself, even if retreat is a possible option?
Well, the first thing that it does is it strikes the clause under reasonable force, and basically it says, requires one to abandon or retreat from one's dwelling or place of business or employment. And that's the under current law. What it replaces it with, though, is a person may be wrong in the estimation of danger or force necessary to repel the danger as long as there is a reasonable basis for the belief of the person and the person acts reasonably in the response to that belief. A person who is not engaged in illegal activity has no duty to retreat from any place where the person is lawfully present before using force as specified in this chapter.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand that correctly, Senator, mm-hmm. if you feel fearful for your life, but perhaps afterwards it's maybe others would presume, well, that wasn't really reasonable. But if you, the person it's happening to, feel fearful for your life, you can defend yourself with lethal force.
It has to be reasonable. I mean, that's the whole issue behind
okay,
it.
Okay, so a judge would see whether that was reasonable or not.
Mm-hmm. And remember, here's what the basis comes down to. I can speak for me and hundreds of thousands of fellow Iowans, that if I see someone being assaulted, if I see someone being raped, my first choice of action isn't to leave. My first choice of action is to try to assist that individual. I'm all, at the same time going to try to call for police backup. I'm going to try to make sure that we're taking care of people. But in the state of Iowa, at least, we have a lot of decent people who want to go out there and do the right things, but our laws prescribe them to not, and that's a problem. And that's what I'm trying to fix with this.
Mm. Okay. Mary Wolf, a state representative from Clinton, bare bones of the bill that Senator Shelgren just described. Do you have a problem with that?
I think there is a widespread misunderstanding of what Iowa law does and doesn't allow right now. So Iowa's current self-defense justification is a legal word for it. Law is set out in Iowa Chapter 704. And the very first statute, 704.1, makes it clear that a Iowan has no duty to retreat, and I'm quoting here, no duty to retreat from any situation involving force if doing so entails a risk of life or safety or the risk or a risk to the life of safety of a third party mm-hmm. or requires one to abandon or retreat from one's dwelling or place of business or employment. So in Iowa, if you are confronted by force either against yourself or another person, you have no duty to retreat unless you can do so 100% safely. Like, it's clear that, and obviously if you come across someone being raped or someone being assaulted, if you retreat, clearly that is that poses a risk to the life or safety of the person who is being raped. So I just, you know, this idea that we do have a stand your ground law in Iowa, and there's such a narrow exception of when you are not allowed to stand your ground that I'm not aware of any case in Iowa in which someone has claimed justification or that they acted in self-defense and they've been found guilty based on a finding that they didn't retreat, because we have almost no obligation to retreat in Iowa.
Senator Shelgren, is that true? Are there any incidents in the recent past that point to the need for this sort of change, that where someone would have defended themselves with lethal force and then was punished for it?
Absolutely, there are. Let me explain this. This is a clarification, because right now, we virtually in the state of Iowa will not prosecute someone who stands their ground. But that doesn't mean that there isn't civil liability, and that individual doing the right thing can still be sued for their possessions, everything they've worked for. And so it's not just a criminality, it's also a civil issue. Mm-hmm. And so we have to take both into account when we look at this.
Can you point to a case or two where you see the it's just too much gray area and needs to be firmed up by a tighter wording in the law?
I'll try to get that information for you directly. I've seen multiple situations where it's come up where someone has had to defend themselves from the civil side of it, and I'll try to get specifics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you don't have
If I could just mention, so in Iowa, under Iowa Code 707.6, a person who injures another person through the use of reasonable force in defense of himself or others or someone else or his property is immune from civil liability. So it is already the law in Iowa that you cannot be sued if you defend yourself, another person, your property, and in doing so, you harm the other person. Now, that doesn't mean that someone can't file a lawsuit, but they can't win.
Representative Wolf, do you know of anyone filing a lawsuit successfully or otherwise?
I don't. The only similar situation was back in, I think, 74, 75. Someone broke into an abandoned farmhouse. There was a trap gun set up to shoot that, you know, someone who breaks in, and that trespasser was allowed to sue the owner of the property on the grounds that the owner wasn't in the home, he wasn't protecting himself, and that other than that very old case, I'm not aware of any case where anybody has been sued because they used reasonable force against an aggressor.
Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100, or river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We have this discussion for another 10 minutes or so. 1-866-780-9100. Just to be clear, Senator Shelgren, do you know of any civil cases that have worked against someone defending themselves, successful or otherwise?
No, I don't know of any recent ones, no.
Mm-hmm. Any ones at all?
None. Yes, I actually am familiar with others. I'll bring the information. I didn't bring all of the notes in for this specific bill. Mm-hmm. I write 25 bills, in the first 2 weeks of session. But I'll get the information for you directly. But what I find interesting about this conversation is we seem to agree. Mm-hmm. We agree that someone who is defending themselves and defending others should have clear and concise rights. So this bill clarifies that. And so I'm not hearing an argument that we shouldn't have these. Matter of fact, I'm hearing the argument that we have these, and that's a good thing. And so by enhancing those and making it clear and concise for the courts, there is absolutely no downside to this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Representative Wolf, you see yourself in complete agreement with Senator Shelgren?
I find myself in complete agreement that Iowans have the right to protect themselves, their family, their possession, and that I guess where we disagree is I believe that under current code, that's already clear. Here's what I will say. Chapter 704 could use some cleaning up. There are some very long, convoluted sentences. It's not as clear as it should be. But with all due respect to Senator Shelgren's legislation, I'm concerned that it would just muddy up the waters and make it much more confusing. So, again, I would just urge everyone, take a look at Chapter 704, go through it. We do have currently stand your ground law in Iowa. You are allowed to use reasonable force, including deadly force, to protect yourself or a third party and under all sorts of other situations. So it's very broad, our current protection.
Senator Shelgren, does your bill make it give the person who is standing their ground, does it give them more leeway to be wrong about the danger that they're in?
I think it should give them more confidence that when they make that decision, the system isn't going to abuse them. And so when you talk about more leeway to be wrong, I mean, it maintains the exact same verbiage with regards to their responsibility to use their best judgment in this process. But at the same time, current laws, I totally agree with Representative Wolf, you know, it is a muddied chapter. We need clarification on that. And whenever you have chapters in Iowa Code that are poorly written or convoluted, it takes that question in a very stressful time whether or not someone should be doing this. Mm-hmm. I know quite a few individuals who believe that they're trying to do the right thing but are fearful that somehow they're going to get caught up into the system. And this makes it very, very clear to them that if you are doing it for the right reasons and you are protecting someone or yourself from a felonious act, then you will be protected.
And Representative Wolf, do you agree that Senator Shelgren's bill makes it gives the person more leeway to be wrong?
Well, two things.
More protection if they're wrong.
Right. Two things. One, I think there is a lot of confusion about what you are allowed to do in Iowa, and part of that is because, with all due respect, as we started this radio show, I think I heard Senator Shelgren saying you are not allowed to stand your ground in Iowa. And, you know, people hear that. They think it's true, and it simply is not. You are allowed to stand your ground. As far as, not so much this bill, but he filed SF-70, and that is where we see the requirement that a person's belief that deadly force is necessary is not required to be reasonable. So basically under SF-70, if a person believes that it is necessary to use deadly force to defend him or herself, then that is considered, then they can do that. And then if it turns out that it was a completely unreasonable belief, or, they killed, you know, their ex-girlfriend and they take the position that I thought she was going to kill me, that's problematic. So right now, you know, there's just a requirement that your belief be reasonable. And that is interpreted, again, very broadly, what a reasonable person would believe based on the circumstances you find themselves in. So, again, I think current law is already extremely protective of Iowans' rights to defend themselves, others, property.
Democratic State Representative Mary Wolf from Clinton, joined by Republican State Senator Mark Shelgren from Ottumwa, our own Joyce Russell, talking about whether a proposal to change Iowa's Stand Your Ground laws, and we have a number of people on the line. Let's before this conversation winds up, let's get some input from listeners in Iowa. Chase is in Davenport. I don't know if we have a bad line there, Chase, but go ahead. I hope we can understand.
Yeah. First of all, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. Recently, in the past 5 years or so, I know concealed weapons permits have become very popular in Iowa. Are there any special clauses with these Stand Your Ground laws that go with those? Because, you know, from what I'm tracking, you know, I can get in trouble for using it for anything, period. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'd just like some clarification on that.
Okay, sure. Jace. Yeah, Senator Shelgren, you want to jump in there?
Well, let me give you two things, first of all. First of all, let's talk about Senate File 70. The reason that Senate File 70 has different qualifications is because it's specifically for your home. And so, therefore, there's a different threshold. And that was written in there intentionally. The second thing about it is when you talk about, concealed carry versus other areas of it, this would have to do with anything. I mean, if you're at a baseball field and you have a baseball bat in your hand, if you have a pocket knife, whatever it might be, the idea behind it is if you feel and you're doing nothing illegal, I mean, it's very clear in the bill, you have to be not doing illegal activity. But if you are legally doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're out shopping, you're going to the mall, you're engaging in day-to-day activities that everyone would acknowledge would be normal activities, then you do not have to be required as part of this to look for an exit if there's a problem. You have the opportunity to be a hero and actually solve a problem potentially. And that comes down to, you know, to whether or not it matters. And not everyone's required. I mean, no one's required to step up to help someone else. That has to do with your own personal conscience. But when that conscience is being influenced because the laws are muddy and difficult, that makes it difficult on people. They have to know that the laws have clarity to say, if you do the right thing, the laws in Iowa will help protect you.
Representative Wolf, do you have something to say to that?
Yeah, I'd just like to say, Chase, I'm sorry. You actually can use your firearm, which you are legally carrying, in defense of yourself, or if you see someone else who is being, you know, raped or beaten, something like that. I mean, you're allowed to protect others, and you won't get in trouble if you use your firearm. So and there is obviously a lack of, we aren't doing a good job of explaining the current law if people believe that, and hopefully that's something maybe various groups can help clarify the current law, which allows people to use a firearm to protect themselves or others if they are confronted with deadly force.
I have a question about the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case in Florida that has been mentioned in connection with Florida's Stand Your Ground law. There's indications that George Zimmerman was acquitted and that the Stand Your Ground law played some role in that, but it also definitely played a role in the fact that he wasn't initially arrested, that the officer came and said, because of our Stand Your Ground law, I can't arrest you. It seems like your bill, Senator Shelgren, does something about that issue of being able to be arrested, that it said you can't be arrested unless there's probable cause that force was unlawful. So would your bill in some way make it harder to arrest?
Well, the issue ends up being is there, you shouldn't be arrested unless there's probable cause that you committed a crime no matter what. So are you suggesting that we shouldn't allow an officer to use probable cause in the arresting of someone? I mean, to me, that yes, I think that someone should not be arrested unless there's probable cause and an officer defines that. I would recommend that your listeners go to Huffington Post. 33 states have Stand Your Ground legislation, five of which, according to the Huffington Post, said that states where there is no civil immunity in Stand Your Ground cases, and Iowa's one of those. That's, all this is doing is clarifying that. And so I'm using that specific information to show that Iowa does not have the same civil protections that we have in the criminal prosecution side of it.
Okay, if I could just, yeah. I would just mention that I certainly respect Huffington Post, but I'm looking at the Iowa Code, and under 707.6, entitled Civil Liability, it grants immunity to people who stand their ground, who reasonably stand their ground in self-protection, so, or protection of another or property. So, I mean, sometimes the internet gets things a little wrong, and I think that's the case where they did.
I understand that.
Well, Senator Shelgren,
but it's muddied water, as you said.
So, Senator Shelgren, does your bill in some way make it give a person more protection from being arrested?
Does it give them more protection from
being arrested? Does it make it harder to arrest someone in a case where, in the George Zimmerman case, where he's obviously shot somebody to death?
I don't think it does. The way the bill was written specifically was that probable cause is still required to be arrested for anything. And so that's one of the issues that we're trusting the police officer to use their best judgment. But this is focused specifically so that the courts understand clearly that someone's civil rights and civil prosecution needs to have the same threshold as criminal prosecution.
I wonder, Senator Shelgren, hearing Representative Wolf's concerns here, I wonder, both chambers are in control, controlled by the Republican, your Republicans, your party. I wonder if in crafting this bill you're open to concerns from the Democrats here so that this could be a bipartisan law, bipartisan bill passing both chambers rather than having it pushed through by the Republicans, which you're in a position to do.
Absolutely. Well, I respect Representative Wolf tremendously, and I appreciate her feedback on this. I'd love to go through the process and show directly what the differences would be in hypothetical situations with regards to potential criminal liability and potential civil liability. And that's what we have our subcommittee and committee processes for, is in order to evaluate the strengths and weaknesses of every bill and make recommendations. And both parties are actively involved in that process.
Yeah, Senator Shelgren, I understand that you have filed this bill how many times? Every year since you've been in the legislature, and so this is your seventh time to file this bill?
Well, it's my seventh year, so actually it's filed every other year because we have 2-year sessions.
Oh, okay, so you filed it every other year. I think that this is a high priority of the Iowa Firearms Coalition and other gun groups. So if you get this through, or anybody who votes for this bill, is that going to be a feather in their cap as far as support from the firearms people?
I really don't care. I try to put bills through that I think are important for the people of Iowa, and whether or not individual groups support or don't support them is somewhat trivial to me.
Mm-hmm. But would you assume that you have a pretty good chance to pass it this year, since Republicans are in the majority?
I think the chances have gone up substantially, yes.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Senator, the civil rights leaders in Iowa oppose this bill, your bill, saying it would subject minorities to more violence and instances of racial profiling. What measures would you take to make sure that doesn't happen, or do you not share that concern?
No. I think that actually, in that concern, I think that individuals of every racial group or every status group deserve to have the right to protect themselves. Whether someone is, whatever gender they are, whatever race they are almost irrelevant in the process. The whole key comes down to Iowans deserve to have full protection of the law, criminally and civilly, to protect themselves and protect their property.
And Representative Wolf, do you share that concern that Ben was mentioning there?
To be honest, no. Okay. I'm not quite. I will say that I also agree that Iowans should have full protection of the law to protect themselves, others, their property. Again, under Iowa Chapter 704, I think they have it, number one. Number two, I think this is a very important issue to a lot of people, including a lot of my constituents. And because of the misinformation and the confusion, which, again, if you just read the code, it clears it up. But I would love to see a joint committee between the Senate and the House, and perhaps Senator Shelgren, Representative Winchittle, could chair it, where we look at the entire, Chapter 704 in its entirety, go through, fix some of the cloudy language, clarify things, and get a lot of input from citizens, law enforcement, people who have to deal with this on a day-to-day basis. So, I think if we did that, at least people would feel that it had a full and fair hearing, and whatever emerges, no one can claim that they didn't get a chance to speak their piece on it.
Okay,
so I would love to help you with that, Senator Shelgren.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Democratic State Representative Mary Wolf, Republican State Senator Mark Shelgren. Thank you both for coming into the State Law Library to talk. And Joyce Russell, thank you for being a part of this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Good job.
Coming up in just a moment, some comments on state politics recorded at last Thursday's Pints and Politics event in Cedar Rapids. We are in partnership with the Gazette in that, talking about hands-free legislation concerning cell phones and driving, water quality, education, funding, development. Also, the debate over minimum wage will be discussed with Gazette political reporter James Lynch, Gazette columnist Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington. That coming up after the break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For the remainder of the hour, some comments on state politics recorded at last Thursday's Pints and Politics event in Cedar Rapids with the Gazette. Our panelists, Gazette political reporter James Lynch, Gazette columnists Todd Dorman and Linda Waddington. I co-hosted the discussion before a live audience with Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette. And we began by asking our panelists how things looked with Republicans now in control of the Senate, in addition to the House and the governor's office. James Lynch began.
Well, so far, it's been sort of quiet, and, Republicans have control of the three legs, the all legs of that three-legged stool they like to talk about, the governor's office, the House, and the Senate. What's interesting is, Republicans have controlled the House for a number of years. In the Senate, Republicans, to some degree, are learning how to be in charge. There's only a few that I can think of who have been there in the Senate in the majority, and of course, one of them would have been David Johnson, but he left the Republican Party and is sort of a caucus of his own. So I think things are going to move slowly at first in terms of they have to, kind of learn how to be in charge and how the process works when you are in charge and you're responsible for sort of the day-to-day operation of the Senate and you're responsible for actually getting some things done. The one thing we have seen is a whole lot of bills being offered by Republicans who, because they are in the majority, those bills will get some attention and will get subcommittee hearings and get a lot of news coverage, things to do away with tenure, to get rid of traffic cameras, to let women sue if they change their mind about having an abortion, you know, giving everybody a gun and things like that. True. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting.
Right. So what are the highest priorities for the Republicans? What bills do you see being written, passed by both chambers, and signed by the governor?
Well, if you ask the leaders, they'll tell you that reducing regulations to help create jobs is one of their highest orders of business. Balancing the budget, obviously. There's, you know, sort of a pent-up demand for tax cuts, although the governor has warned that the state can't afford tax cuts and that bad tax cuts are just as bad as bad spending. So I don't know how they're going to deal with that. But we're 2 weeks into the session, and you're starting to see that maybe everybody isn't singing from the same page in the hymnal. Same hymnal, but not the same page. Some people are, you know, writing their own harmonies.
Or disharmonies.
Disharmonies, as the case may be, yes.
We actually had a question from the audience about Branstad and the legislature's views on tax cuts. I mean, is there any chance that the legislature will just say, too bad, we're cutting them anyway?
Yes.
Okay, there we go.
But I think, given the current budget situation, they're going to have to be clever about it in a way that it's probably more likely to be tax reform. You know, we're changing how we tax, so it's a better way of taxing, or something that doesn't take effect this year, that takes effect next year or 2 years or something like that down the road. I mean, I think one easy thing they could do is an idea that's been out there for a number of years, that you would have your a choice of either filing your taxes in the current way or just doing a flat tax. There would be sort of this dual track for taxes. That would be something they could do, and I think the governor would sign. It wouldn't necessarily change your tax burden or the revenue the state collects, but that would be tax reform.
What about minimum wage? We have thousands of Iowans at the start of this year, 2017, have received a wage. Minimum wage went up in several Iowa counties to the south of us. Johnson County was at the forefront of this movement. Now minimum wage in Johnson County tops $10 an hour. Other counties, Polk County, and also here in Linn County. Explain the dynamics of this, because Republicans like to say they are in favor of local control. Here's an example of local control, counties saying we need a minimum wage here, but then the lawmakers in Des Moines saying, hey, hold on. What's behind the hey, hold on?
Well, I think a couple things, but chiefly a lot of business groups are saying they want to have a uniform wage, they want consistency, that they don't want to have to pay one minimum wage in one county and another minimum wage in a different county. And there is an argument, you know, that you can make for having one minimum wage for the state. And, you know, you can certainly make the case that the minimum wage needs to be higher. And I don't hear a lot of people disagreeing with that. But I think it falls into that category of, we want to make Iowa as appealing to job creators, so we want to have a uniform, consistent minimum wage. But I'm not sure why we would want to make Iowa appealing to job creators who are paying minimum wage, but that's probably another argument.
Yeah, there's a lot of sentiment to get rid of what they call the hodgepodge, which is a bunch of counties having different wages. I'm not sure the hodgepodge is all bad, but businesses say it is. The question is, I think there's a lot of, it sounds like there's a lot of support for getting rid of the hodgepodge and basically telling counties that they can't do that again. And in fact, I think there are some lawmakers that already think it's unconstitutional for counties to do that, but they're going to turn off that spigot, do some preemption. The question is how much, if any, do they raise the current state minimum wage? It's been 10 years, I think, roughly, since it's been raised. And if you're going to have a minimum wage, I guess you raise it periodically, and 10 years seems like a long time. But a lot of there are Republican interests, business interests, that don't like the idea of raising the minimum because it does have some ripple effect, affects some wages above that. Although it's kind of the funny dual argument, don't raise the minimum wage because it's going to cost us too much, but you don't raise the minimum wage because no one makes the minimum wage. You sort of hear both arguments. It's hard to believe that both of those are the case.
Education is on the minds of at least one of our audience members here. The question verbatim, how do we plan on correcting the ship in regards to education funding and development? So under this unified government, under the Republicans, what changes does our panel see in regards to how the state funds, well, let's say K through 12 and then take higher education as well?
Well, Governor Branstad has proposed a 2% increase in school aid this year and again next year, which is probably half or a third of what Democrats would like to see. And it's early in the session, so they'll negotiate and bargain back and forth and probably end up on 2%, which...
Democrats have half to a third of the votes they'd like to have. So.
Yes, exactly. So yeah. We probably know the results. Beyond that, I don't know what they're going to do to change that. I think, really there's going to be... people might be happy to get 2% given the current budget situation. Community colleges and the Regents universities might be in a worse position given current budget situation when it comes to, hoping for more money next year and the following year.
Has there been any movement in Des Moines regarding
No.
the fund? Regarding the education funding formula and what's going on with Davenport and their superintendent and the ethics investigation and all that?
There was a meeting about that sometime this week. There was no decision made, but there was a meeting to talk about the equity issue that Davenport has been raising. I don't hear people saying that that's a priority, that fixing that is a priority this year.
Are we going to get it funded in the first 30 days?
I think so. There's a lot of talk about doing that. The way things are going right now, they'll probably approve the deappropriation bill for the current year budget and set the next year school aid probably like one day and the next day, like one right after the other. But then on the third day, they will repeal that law that says they have to set it within 30 days.
Water quality is something that has been put on the agenda. The governor has also mentioned Iowa's, in many cases, poor water quality. I understand there's general agreement among lawmakers, also across the aisle, that there is a need for water quality improvements. So what approach are we likely to see under the Republicans in 2017?
It would be near the top of the list of priorities if... I'm not sure what they're going to do, although they keep coming back to the bill the House passed last year is a good starting point. I was talking to Bill Northey, the Secretary of Agriculture, earlier this week. He said he would be happy if that was what the end result was, if the bill that was passed by the House last year. The funding, it's like $475 million over 13 years. He would be happy if the legislature approved that. There's still talk about the sales tax and funding the Natural Resources Trust Fund, but there's also a lot of talk about we're not going to raise taxes. So I think the House version probably will get tweaked, but I think that's probably what we're looking at.
Yeah, the House bill has good points. It does put more money into it. Bill Northey's probably happy because a lot of that money will go to the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship, which he heads. I guess my trepidation with that bill is last year when I tried to ask lawmakers, how do you measure success of that? How do you measure the success of that bill? You put all that money into water quality. How do we know anything's working? And they basically told me, well, we're going to be able to count the number of projects. And I'm not, and I'm sure the number of projects is one measure of success. But the idea that, you know, we sort of need to test water and figure out whether some of this stuff is happening. And also there's a question of permanence. The House bill funds it for 13 years. And a lot of these projects, I mean, farmers get a grant. They put in measures. There's no law that says they necessarily have to keep those measures into the future. If crop prices go up, you know, some farmers might tear out some of the conservation measures and plant crops. I mean, that's the difficulty. I mean, we probably need some, you know, if we don't have mandatory regulations, we at least need some benchmarks and some guidelines and measurements to tell us whether all this money that we're throwing at this problem is actually doing some good. Sometimes I get the impression that that farm groups and agriculture groups would rather just have the money and the measurement can just kind of go by the wayside.
Are we going to get to the point, and this is the subject of a lawsuit, where ag industry is viewed as any other industry in terms of the degree to which they may pollute or have to clean up the water they soil?
Well, and we're probably going to see some legislation that attempts to maybe change the way the Des Moines Water Works is structured, who filed the lawsuit, maybe trying to kind of end around that and maybe say that drainage districts can't be sued, although court rulings have said that they can't be sued. So I think we may see both the sort of water quality initiative and then on the other side this effort to kind of blunt that lawsuit or make it go away or preclude other lawsuits from being filed. I hope that they sort of put their attention on trying to fix the problem rather than trying to fix the legal system so they don't have to worry about it.
Well, and you've written in the past that you would rather them hold off than pass something that's not going to be effective and then say that they fixed it.
Yeah, the fear is that they pass something that's not effective and then they say, well, we did water quality. We don't have to do that again. And, I mean, that's in some ways that's worse than doing nothing. But I also, you know, to see funding go into projects, that's probably better than nothing.
I think that's where the debate, a lot of the debate will be, is about those benchmarks that, and this is a case that Democrats make, is that if we're spending this money, that we should measure it and see that we're making progress. So I think that's where the debate is going to be in tweaking that law and saying, okay, these are the benchmarks we're going to set so that if we're funding this for 13 years, at the end of, you know, 3 years, what will we see? At the end of, you know, 10 years, at the end of 13 years, you know, how much improvement will we have made? Because just spending money on it doesn't necessarily solve the problem, and just increasing the number of projects doesn't necessarily solve the problem.
If you've just joined us, this is Pints in Politics, a special edition of River to River, presented by the Gazette in partnership with Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer of Iowa Public Radio with Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette, and also so glad to hear the insights of political reporter James Lynch, columnist Todd Dorman, and Linda Waddington. We're live before an audience at CSPS in Cedar Rapids, and so grateful that CSPS host us for this community event to put our heads together, talk about politics the good old-fashioned way, not by tweeting, not by anonymous comments sent out over the Internet, by looking each other in the eye, Todd, and I'm looking at you, and saying, I disagree with you. I don't see it that way.
Just generally?
Generally.
Just generally. All right. Well, let's move on to texting while driving. That's another bill. There's a movement to make all hands full phone use in the car illegal. That you can only use your phone hands free. Is that bill a good idea? Is it going to pass? What do you guys have to say about that?
Well, it's going to be an interesting argument because you have people from both parties on both sides or all sides of that issue. I think everybody wants to do something about texting while driving. The question is, you know, do you make it a primary offense so that if a law officer sees you texting while driving, they can pull you over? Or do you go, you know, sort of all the way and say, you know, no handheld devices? And then this raises all those issues about my personal freedoms to use my phone in my car. And, you know, what is distracted driving, you know, if I'm putting on makeup, if I'm eating a sandwich, if I'm reading the newspaper, shouldn't that be the same as holding a hand, a phone in your hand? I think they'll do something, and in probably legislative tradition, they'll do sort of the minimum this year and come back and, you know, attack it again in the future. But there is this interesting coalition of people who say, look, truckers are, you know, already have to have hands-free. Why shouldn't, you know, if the professional drivers have to be hands-free, why shouldn't the rest of us amateurs have to be hands-free?
The Iowa ACLU coming out against this, thinking it will contribute to profiling. I guess that surprised me a bit. I don't know if you were surprised by that as well.
They're against the making it a primary offense.
Yes.
Because they think that may increase racial profiling. They were saying if you make it, you have to be hands-free, that would be a better solution. I guess I hadn't thought of that one way or another from that perspective.
Clap if you have texted and driven in the last week. Be honest.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. And the one statistic that was brought out
problem.
It's not.
The one
statistic, we think this is a routine, but talking with someone, a traffic expert, if you are going 55, 60 miles an hour and you take your eyes off the road for 5 seconds, you have traveled the length of a football field without seeing anything.
And I think it goes far beyond texting. I think that's part of what the ACLU is talking about and making this distinction of just don't have your hands on a phone, because you have people checking Facebook. You have people, you know, reading Donald Trump's tweets and people playing Pokemon Go, which I see quite often around Cedar Rapids. So you have all of these other things, and the more that this integrates with our reality, the more temptation there is to use your phone. It's not just texting anymore. It's not just email. It's not just phone calls. It's all these other things that pop up while you're driving.
The audience member, if we didn't hear that, self-driving cars, why are we worrying about it? It'll be here in 5 years. Self-driving cars, we get in. It's the Jetsons.
How many people are going to die in 5 years?
Well, my daughter turned 15 today, so I'm for banning all of it, every single thing, including food and reading and playing a musical instrument or whatever.
I still want to know what kind of makeup James Lynch wears.
I think they're going to do something, but I think about what do lawmakers do, and that will be exempted. They talk on their phone, on their handheld phones. I don't think they'll ban that. Because I don't know how many conversations I've had with lawmakers while they're driving. And so you always got to wonder, how is it going to affect lawmakers, and then sort of delete that part?
You know, it's not a problem. I can talk on my phone and drive, and it's not a problem at all. But I have noticed a lot of people, you know, as you're driving along and you notice the people in the next car, and they're having a conversation on their phone, and you can tell they're not paying attention. But I don't...
That's exactly right. That's happened to me.
Yeah?
That's exactly the same thing. Other people are the worst.
We have an audience member who wants to know, and this is a great question, how can citizens give their input to Iowa legislators? What's the best way to be in touch with them? Is it an email? Is it flowers? Is it a phone call?
Food.
Yeah, they like treats.
Food.
Cookies.
Give them a free breakfast, free lunch, free reception in the evening.
Those big Subway sandwiches?
Yeah. They like those. Pizza is always good. I think email probably reaches people. I don't think calling, because it's really hard to get a hold of most of them. But I mean, I think email is probably the way they prefer.
Put your indictment in the subject line.
Yeah.
Then they'll make sure to read it. Malfeasance. Hey.
One of the things that they'll say is they like to hear from people in their district. They really don't care to hear from people, you know, if they're a Cedar Rapids legislator, they don't necessarily care to hear from somebody in Sioux County. You know, they're not interested as much as hearing from their own constituents. So, you know, a lot of groups will send emails to every legislator, you know, hundreds of emails, and I'm not sure that does a lot of good. But it's important to know your legislator and contact them through email or phone if you're more, you know, comfortable with that. Those are the things that get their attention.
Some of the discussion of state politics recorded last Thursday evening in Cedar Rapids before an audience at CSPS. I was joined by Linda Waddington, Todd Dorman, James Lynch, and Jennifer Hemmingson of the Gazette. By the way, the next Pints and Politics event is scheduled for the evening of February 23rd at the Mill in Iowa City. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. On-site sound engineering by Jim Davies, also help from Chelsea Hoy. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.